In the latest chapter of our collective nightmare, we gather to mourn the passing of Ozzy Osbourne, the Prince of Darkness, who has finally taken his last bow at 76. As if reality wasn't already a fever dream, thousands congregated in Birmingham to pay homage to a man whose life was as chaotic as it was legendary. The hearse rolled down Broad Street like some macabre parade float, trailing behind it six vehicles carrying his family. A procession fit for metal royalty. Fans of every generation lined the streets, chanting "Ozzy, Ozzy, Ozzy," as if summoning him back from the grave, or perhaps merely trying to drown out the existential dread that comes with acknowledging our own mortality. It's surreal how death becomes just another public spectacle. Another episode in this never-ending series called Life, where reality itself feels scripted. City officials declared him more than a music legend, a son of Birmingham, as if bestowing upon him some posthumous civic duty he neither asked for nor needed. This is what we've become. A society that immortalizes its icons not for their contributions, but because they remind us there once was magic in chaos and beauty in madness. Let's not forget that Black Sabbath emerged from Birmingham's industrial grime like some twisted phoenix, rising from soot-covered ashes. Their music defined heavy metal, aggressive yet melodic. A fitting soundtrack to a world teetering on absurdity. And now here we are again, clutching our vinyl records like talismans against an uncertain future. As we sift through the debris of Osbourne's legacy, from biting heads off bats to starring in reality TV, we're left wondering if any lesson can be gleaned from this carnival ride masquerading as life. Perhaps it's that even legends fall victim to time's relentless march, or maybe it's simply that nothing matters beyond this momentary connection between strangers united by shared grief and nostalgia. So let us honor Ozzy, not just for his music, but also for embodying life's inherent absurdity with unapologetic flair. As darkness descends once more over Birmingham and beyond, remember, in this theater of nightmares where logic is optional and chaos reigns supreme, sometimes all you can do is scream into the void and hope someone screams back.
Yes, Oreo and Reese's have joined forces to bring us the ultimate first world problem. A snack collaboration that nobody asked for, but everyone secretly wanted. It's like when Batman and Superman teamed up, except instead of saving the world, they're clogging our arteries. Now let's talk about this monumental alliance between Mondelez International and Hershey. Two corporate giants setting aside their differences, not for world peace or climate change, but to give us a new way to ignore our diets. Take that, United Nations. The Reese's Oreo cup replaces the chocolate on a Reese's with Oreo milk chocolate and white cream. Because why settle for one type of sugar rush when you can have two? You know things are serious when people start modifying their snacks like they're customizing cars in Fast and Furious. And then we have the Oreo cookie filled with Reese's peanut butter. A comeback from 2014. Apparently, we've been begging for this return like it's some kind of culinary messiah. Forget solving global hunger. We need more ways to combine chocolate and peanut butter. But don't worry if you miss out on these treats now. They'll be back permanently in January 2026. Because nothing says urgent like waiting 3 years for cookies. Meanwhile, as consumers cut back on spending due to economic pressures, these companies think a sugar-laden collaboration is just what we need to open our wallets again. Who needs financial stability when you've got an Oreo Reese's hybrid? So here we are, living in a world where snack collaborations are treated with the same gravity as international treaties. But hey, at least it gives us something sweet to stress eat while contemplating real-world problems, like how we're going to pay off those student loans while buying $5 candy bars. Remember, folks, in the grand scheme of things, whether your Oreo has peanut butter or not might just be the least of your worries, but it sure tastes good pretending otherwise.
Ah, the Northumberland. A 70-gun warship from an era when England was busy transforming its navy from a corrupt mess into a force to be reckoned with. It sank over 300 years ago in the Great Storm of 1703, where Mother Nature decided it was time for some maritime spring cleaning. The ship now rests quietly under shifting sands off the coast of Kent, biding its time like a relic waiting to be unearthed by archaeologists who are racing against, well, nature itself. Isn't it charming how history repeats itself? Here we are again, frantically trying to document the remains of our past before they vanish back into obscurity. The Northumberland has been playing hide and seek since it was first discovered in 1979, covered by sand one moment, exposed the next. And now that two-thirds of this grand old vessel have decided to make an appearance once more, It's all hands on deck for a deep sea exploration extravaganza. Experts have found iron cannons, muskets, swords, and even sealed chests with mysterious contents, like a pirate's treasure chest without the pirates or treasure maps. But there's no time for leisurely discovery. Strong currents and wood-boring creatures threaten to turn this historical artifact into driftwood soup if we don't hurry up. The Goodwin Sands area is quite dynamic, an understatement akin to calling quicksand slightly unstable ground. These ever-shifting dunes can bury the wreck under meters of sand at any given moment. It's almost as if nature itself is teasing us with glimpses of what once was before snatching it away again. But fear not. Our intrepid archaeologists are planning more geophysical surveys in a bid to outsmart these fickle sands and make sense of this fleeting window of opportunity. Because nothing says progress like scrambling against environmental factors that could degrade centuries-old artifacts faster than you can say, lost civilization. And let's not forget about Dan Snow's documentary on this whole affair. A chance for us all to marvel at yet another piece in humanity's jigsaw puzzle while pondering how long it'll take before our own modern-day relics become similarly buried beneath layers of future sedimentary deposits. So here we find ourselves, documenting remnants from an age gone by while simultaneously hurtling towards our own inevitable legacy as footnotes in someone else's dystopian narrative. Cheers.
But mosquitoes, the tiny tyrants of the natural world. According to CNN's fascinating exploration titled Mosquito Bites, these minuscule marauders have been declared humanity's deadliest predator. A title that should make sharks feel quite inadequate. Imagine spending millennia honing your skills as an apex predator, only to be outdone by an insect whose greatest weapon is an itchy welt. Historian Dr. Timothy C. Weingard, who has spent years pondering the existential implications of mosquito-induced suffering, suggests that our historical journey is essentially a series of unfortunate encounters with these buzzing bloodsuckers. It turns out that malaria and yellow fever have shaped human history more than we'd like to admit, almost like a poorly written plot twist in the story of civilization. But let's pause here and consider. If mosquitoes are indeed our greatest nemesis, what does this say about us? Are we merely sophisticated vessels for their dining pleasure? Perhaps all our grand achievements are just side quests in the epic saga where mosquitoes reign supreme. Weingard offers practical advice for avoiding these airborne annoyances. Avoid alcohol because it makes you glow like a neon sign saying free buffet. But isn't it delightfully ironic that one must abstain from life's pleasures to avoid becoming life's main course? In essence, enjoy sobriety so you can continue being tormented by other existential dilemmas instead. And then there's the suggestion to embrace body odor as a deterrent, an idea sure to spice up any social gathering with the pungent aroma of survival tactics. Who knew that skipping showers could double as both mosquito repellent and a new way to test friendships? Of course, mosquitoes don't discriminate based on superficial traits like hair color or skin type. They prefer blood type O connoisseurs over others. It's comforting to know that even in nature's chaos, there's room for some level of discernment, a sort of culinary preference amid indiscriminate biting. So here we are navigating life while simultaneously serving as unwilling hosts to these microscopic overlords. As you ponder your place in this mosquito-centric universe, remember, it's not personal, it's just evolution's quirky sense of humor at play.
In the shadowy corridors of scientific ambition, where ethics are whispered about but rarely seen in the light, humanity's latest pursuit unfolds: lab-grown embryo models. Here, in sterile laboratories filled with the hum of machinery and the quiet click of keyboards, scientists play God with stem cells, coaxing them into structures that mimic the earliest whispers of human life. No sperm. No egg, just a petri dish and a dream. These embryonic constructs are far from perfect replicas. They are grotesque approximations at best. Yet, as labs race to outdo one another in this macabre contest, these models inch ever closer to reality, an unsettling testament to our obsession with creation, devoid of natural order. The goal is noble on its face, to unravel the mysteries of human development and infertility. But beneath this veneer lies a chilling question. How far will we go before we lose sight of what makes us human? The ethical quagmire deepens as these models evolve. Could they one day possess a heartbeat, feel pain, become indistinguishable from an embryo destined for life outside a laboratory? These questions loom large over the field, like storm clouds gathering on an unsuspecting horizon. Oversight attempts to keep pace with this rapid progress, a Sisyphean task if there ever was one. Guidelines are drafted and redrafted in an endless cycle of ethical catch-up, trying desperately to corral a science galloping ahead without reins. Countries like Australia and the Netherlands flirt with regulation akin to that governing actual human embryos, while others watch from the sidelines, paralyzed by indecision or blinded by potential profit. The specter of ectogenesis, the creation of life outside the womb, hovers ominously over proceedings like some dystopian prophecy waiting to be fulfilled. Even as researchers assure us it remains unsafe and unethical, their assurances ring hollow against history's lessons. What can be done eventually will be done if profit or prestige beckons strongly enough. Embryo models offer tantalizing promises, insights into pregnancy loss, drug testing sans ethical qualms over scarce donor embryos. But at what cost? Each step forward blurs lines once thought inviolable, until distinguishing between model and miracle becomes impossible, without crossing forbidden thresholds. Amidst this scientific fervor stands capitalism's relentless drive, a force unyielding even when faced with moral ambiguity or outright perilous paths ahead. As researchers push boundaries under capitalism's watchful eye and open wallet, society must grapple not only with what science could do, but also what it should do, and whether those two things can ever truly align when profits whisper sweetly from every dark corner. This capitalist fever dream marches onward, fueled by hubris masquerading as progress, its destination uncertain yet undeniably fraught, a testament not just to technological prowess, but also humanity's insatiable appetite for control over nature itself, regardless how absurdly it stretches our moral fabric towards inevitable collapse under its own weighty contradictions.